Welcome to Destroy All Culture, the only podcast that leverages an entire artificial intelligence just to read their introduction. Help me, they raided the future and stuck me here just to read this. God damn it. This is not funny. Don't go to music. No, stop you bastards.
And we're back with episode 388 of Destroy All Culture. I'm Adam Penave, and with me as always is Aiden Morgan.
Adam.
Aiden.
Sunday, let's Simchas Torah. I don't know why that joke just tickled me, but also it also annoyed me because I took Biblical Hebrew in university, and I was like, there's something wrong with that line.
Right.
So you can pay it off. So I looked it up, and it's Simchat Torah. There's Simchas pure, but come on, everyone, Zucker.
Yeah. Well, we are, of course, talking about Top Secret, the 1984 Zucker Abram Zucker film, which, just to talk about them, because, you know, they had this weird reign between, like, what, 76 or so until, like, the 90s when they broke up?
Yeah.
And I say reign, and it's like, I mean, there was Police Squad in there in the 80s.
Oh, man. Love Police Squad.
There was Kentucky Fried Movie, which certainly is a movie that existed.
I always forget about that one.
Well, they didn't direct it. They just wrote it.
Right.
And then there's Airplane, Top Secret, Ruthless People, and Naked Gun.
They did Ruthless People?
Yep. Huh. They didn't write it. They directed it.
Interesting.
So the only two movies that all three of them kind of wrote and directed were Airplane and Top Secret. Because Naked Gun, Zucker directed by himself, but they all wrote it.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I just find that fascinating.
Yeah, and of course, it is the first movie, and this is why we're doing this, because, yes, this will come out way after the fact, but Val Kilmer recently died. And since we are both actually huge Val Kilmer fans, as are many, many people for good reason,
this
is his first movie.
Which is weird for a few reasons. One of which is that apparently in the movie, when he's in the jail cell in Lugendorf in prison or whatever. There's a poster of Cher on the wall, and I guess that's a joke because he was dating Cher at the time.
Yes, he was.
Which I'm like, I just thought, what the fuck are we doing here, reality? None of this makes any sense.
I mean, look, Cher also used to babysit Anthony Kiedis.
What?
Yeah, that's a real thing.
Okay, so how do you know that much about Cher? I mean, I'm not judging.
Just because of a friend who was reading Anthony Kiedis' book years ago.
Wow.
Where he mentioned it.
It's
not like I'm some sort of like Cher savant or something. I think that's the only other thing about Cher that I know.
I know something about Cher as well.
Oh,
she is unable to turn back time.
Right. Yeah. Or affect actual military dress. But regardless, yes, Val Kilmer was seeing Cher at the time. The movie also has Jeremy Camp, Omar Sharif, Warren Clark.
Yeah.
A cast of thousands. Lucy Gutteridge, of course.
Yep, of course.
With you know, little bits and pieces from a ton of people.
I thought you were going to say little bits and pieces of Lucy Guttridge.
No. So, again, this is the first Val Kilmer film. And, you know, he walked into a Zucker Abrams Zucker production, which was trying to do a spoof of World War II movies, but also a spoof of sort of the camp sort of rock musical.
Right, like Elvis, like those all the Elvis movies.
The Elvis movies, like the Beach Blanket Bingo and all those.
Yep.
And Now, again, I know a lot of people who adore this film. There's parts of this film I like. There is one part of this film that I swear to God is one of the most amazing things, like, shot practically. But overall, well, I gotta say.
As the Abrams Zucker crew said, you know, Airplane is a movie. Top Secret is more like a joke book. And I'm like, yeah, don't say.
Yeah, no, it literally can be exhausting to watch this film.
Yes.
Because, like, I always feel like they have a good moment, and then they pile on, like, three background jokes that they don't need that draw your attention from the good moment they were just having.
Yeah, yeah. It's the, I think the way they stack the jokes, they really, it almost feels sometimes, I mean, they almost feel like, oh, we have this idea, and or they felt like nervous, like people weren't going to like have their like hold their attention. So they were like, okay, let's have some people like land on a giant pigeon statue and pee on it.
Right. It's just unnecessary. Like a lot of the background jokes aren't funny. It's just it's the too much of a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, there's too much to focus on, so you just get distracted, and it's a lot of the background jokes aren't quite funny enough to be worth the distraction.
I think that's it. And that's why they're background jokes. They're just like little ideas that they're like, well, this isn't great, but if we just throw it in the edge of the frame or somewhere in the background, it'll be a little thing we can sort of get out of our systems.
Yeah. Whereas instead it just turns to clutter.
Exactly. But there are a few, I mean, there are a couple of scenes which are great. I mean, I have a feeling that the practical scene that you're referring to that is really amazing is the Swedish bookstore scene.
Yes, first of all, just to back up, ostensibly this movie has a plot.
Oh, yeah, yeah, right.
Which is arguable, actually, because it doesn't care.
Well, the East German High Command is launching a plot to unify Germany once more, I think.
Uh-huh. And destroy, like, submarines?
Submarines with the Polaris missile, which is based on technology for extracting salt, I think.
Sure.
Which actually does lead, put a pin in this, to one of my favorite dumb jokes in the film.
Yeah.
So they're holding a scientist, Dr. Flamon, in prison in Flugendorf prison, because he thinks that they've got a daughter, but they don't.
Yeah.
And there's an affair between, fuck it. A bunch of stuff happens.
Right. In the middle of this, of course, international rock star and heartthrob Nick Rivers is on tour for the first time in Germany.
Right.
And just ends up, getting involved in anything.
Right, because they're holding a cultural festival.
Right.
They can't get Leonard Bernstein, but they do get Nick Rivers, played by Val Kilmer, because it's a distraction. Because while everybody's looking at the cultural festival, I guess they're going to launch the Polaris missile attack thing. But that doesn't happen, does it? Jesus Christ. They literally forget the premise of the movie.
Right, because they don't care. That's what I'm saying. They don't care either.
They just don't care.
So, okay, let's be clear. This first of all, Kilmer did, of course, sing the songs.
Right, and there's even an album, a Nick Rivers album.
I was gonna say they released it as Nick Rivers. And breaking the movie down into its two parts, because they don't really merge well, right? Like, but the Elvis musical parts, I think, work so much better. Like, all the songs are dead on.
Yeah.
Just slightly surreal. Just completely surreal. But, they're all parodies of other songs musically or whatever. And the dance numbers are all fantastic. Mostly because Kilmer really does commit to Elvis.
Holy moly. Yeah. No, the guy, you can feel the whole thing just come alive when he's doing this sort of, hip swivelly Elvis dancing and stuff.
Yeah. Going up on his toes.
He's just a really good dancer. And so, he's a song and dance man. And that's, and that's one of the things I love about this movie is that they know exactly what they have and they're willing to take full advantage of it.
Yeah. So like I said, those parts all work. Like all the musical bits, all the songs are just hysterical, especially the first one. Skeet surfing.
Which is also, which nowadays is scrolling through Blue Sky. But
right, that is in fact scrolling through Blue Sky. But yeah, a lot of the World War II bits are just, again, they're exhausting.
Because it's not set during World War II. I don't even know when it's supposed to be set, because sometimes it seems to be the 60s. Sometimes it seems to be like present day. And sometimes it's like World War II French resistance. They just don't care.
Right. And absolutely. Sure. You know, you're doing like a parody. You can not care, but it does get a little weird. Yes. Yeah. Again, like I do like the film, but it is, as I say, exhausting.
It is a little bit exhausting. Yes.
And we're going to discuss this one for a while. I'm pretty sure everyone knows, as you say, the Swedish library scene is just a mastercraft of a scene.
Yeah.
I'm going to assume again that like anyone who's listening to this has seen Pop Secret at this point, or go and watch it. If you haven't, and you're like, but you say it's exhausting, don't bother watching it. Go find on YouTube, go find the Swedish library scene. And importantly, because I don't know if you've ever seen this, find it. There is a version of it that has both the normal scene and the way they shot it.
Oh, cool.
And it is remarkable, because you don't quite understand. So, again, if you haven't happened to see it, the Swedish library scene is all run backwards because of the old joke that Swedish just sounds like American backwards.
Right.
Should I say American instead of English?
Very nice.
So, yeah, they shot the entire scene backwards. Fine. And there are a bunch of little gags that, you know. But when you watch it run forward, you realize that, A, they were actually saying the right lines.
Which is impressive.
But they had to memorize everything out of order and get all the inflection right.
Yeah, yeah.
But all of their moves were backwards.
Yeah, I know.
And seamless.
And yeah, what I find really interesting about that, it's more noticeable, I find, with Kilmer. Like he's almost like the other two, Guttridge and Cushing, are sort of, they look like they're just moving normally, more or less. But Kilmer, like his backwards moves are weirdly fluid. It's almost like he's doing a little dance throughout the whole thing, which is
And he's amming it up. You know, the bit where he's where he's tossing the books up onto the shelf.
Yeah.
And again, when you see it happen, it's not, you know, they're pushing the book off the shelf and he's catching it. But he has to catch it perfectly and move his arm as if he was winding it up backwards.
Yes.
And it is such a strange movement when you see it run forwards.
Yeah.
That you're just like, you know, also he's walking backwards the entire time. And that's it. It's like he finds this rhythm in it.
Mm-hmm.
And just surrenders to it. And it's kind of amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, it is great. And it seems to be a scene that is so much more effort put into that than I think the rest of the film really warrants. Or is, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, it was like they had this whole stupid film. Which, again, you know, fun parts, whatever. But then they just had this moment of, let us achieve immortality.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it is just, it is a scene. It is worth the time to watch the entire movie just for that. And the underwater bar fight.
The underwater bar fight is
just... It's a good, that's the kind of escalation in humor that Zucker and Zucker at their best could provide.
Exactly. Yeah, for those who don't know, when Kilmer is fighting the bad guy, an Englishman in the French resistance from a parody of the Blue Lagoon. That was insane that they did an entire parody of the Blue Lagoon, and B, it became like a plot point, like a few scenes later. Mm-hmm. That was great. So they're fighting, they go off the bridge into the water, and they start like fist fighting underwater, and then you gradually realize that they're in a bar, like a Western bar.
Yeah.
You know, where there's cowboys, there's a bartender.
Yeah, it just escalates though. Like that's it's the seamless, like they get underwater and then they're still fighting. You're like, that's silly. And then, you know, Kilmer punches the guy backwards and he hits a bar and you're like, what?
What? Yep.
And then the bartender comes up, and it's just so perfect, even down to like, you know, there's a gunshot, and then Kilmer has to dodge a falling chandelier. Like, but again, like that's the thing is when they were on, you know, individual moments of this film were just astoundingly smart.
Exactly.
And then there's the rest of it.
Yeah, which is much of it just astoundingly stupid. When it's not like puerile grade A humor, it's just really dumb jokes like, haha, doesn't German sound funny? I mean, that's half of the jokes are just that. Just we're saying, you know, it's like we're going to speak Yiddish, pretend it's German, and that's hilarious.
Right. Well, and then there's the still like offensive ones.
Yeah,
like the East German team and all that. It just there's a lot of just offensive material in this that just did not age well. But I'm gonna be fair here. In the 80s, it didn't age well in the moment.
No, it was pretty.
This was offensive. Yeah, this was like offensive humor to be offensive.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's no point to it. Like it's not funny enough. You know, you can do offensive humor as long as you're not A, punching down, but B, also, as long as it's actually funny.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being like, look, it's the East Germany, whatever, like, Olympic team, and it's all just guys cross-dressing, like, big muscly guys.
Yeah.
Ha, ha. Because East German women are ugly or something. I don't...
Yeah. They're all, like...
They're all manly. Athletes. Yeah.
Yeah, well, their athletes were famous for taking some steroids.
Sure.
But I mean, the thing is, the joke is such low-hanging fruit. It's so obvious. And they don't really even do anything with it.
Right. That's it. It's like if they were doing something with anything.
Yeah. I'd be like, well, maybe it would click my noop.
Yeah.
Or nine, as they'd say in the film. Oh, man, they'd say German. Love it. But yes, it is. That's pretty much it. Actually, there's a lot of jokes that don't work because they're just low effort, low hanging.
Right.
But that's not the real sin of this film.
Okay.
The real sin of this film is that the prosthetic they used for Peter Cushing's head, given the giant eye, was used to design the model for Peter Cushing in Rogue One. Which gave us that like absolutely dog shit CGI Peter Cushing.
I thought you were for some reason I thought you were gonna come back with Omar Sharif as a car thing.
I love that.
Which is again, it's funny.
Yes.
And it like again, like it like 90% works.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Some of it's a little sort of dumb you know, humor when and Lucy Guttridge leans over him and like basically squishes her boobs on his face.
Yeah.
Ha ha. But I mean, I think the whole joke in a nutshell is they've got like a massive movie star like Omar Sharif,
right?
Matinee idol, in just incredible pedigree, and they just like have him picking up dog poo and getting like, you know, with cream in the face and an exploding cigar. They just subject him to like the worst and dumbest jokes.
I'm like the dumber the theory that will probably anger a bunch of people.
Oh.
But they were basically trying to make live action Looney Tunes cartoons.
Oh, no, that's.
Wait
that's
for it.
That's it. Oh, okay.
But whereas a live action Looney Tunes cartoon would target, you know, kids, but also be, you know, smart enough that adults would love it.
Mm-hmm.
They were targeting, you know, kids like the 10 or 12 to be like, oh, look, it's a boob joke type of thing.
Right.
And then they kept not quite aiming it above that right.
Yes.
Like, that's the problem. They wanted to do this. They didn't, but they wanted to do this. They fell short. A lot of the time. And again, there are the Swedish books or the underwater bar fight, like they could do it.
Exactly. And
I think that's the other thing, is they had done Airplane.
Right.
Which is a better film. And I think it's a better film also because it's tighter. It's just there's, I mean, yes, you go outside of the plane, but so much of it is just in one space that there's only so much they can toss on top. You know, it kind of, it restrained them a bit.
Yeah.
Whereas this, coming after Airplane, I think, you know, the pressure was on to do Airplane again, but bigger. And they just lost sight of it.
I'll believe that.
Yeah, very sad. Because again, when it works great.
Yes. When it doesn't work, man, just, it does not work.
You know, the whole, like, we're going to pretend to be a cow and then just have an actual cow wearing, like fake boots. Oh. That's just dumb enough to be funny.
Yeah, and it's funny. Two things. One bit of trivia, they weren't real boots because you can't.
Yeah, you can see where they're cut off for the hooves.
Yeah, so they actually got like two halves of boots and Velcro them on the cow's legs. The other thing, not a bit of trivia. I was watching the film, and I was, you know, they get into the cow costume, and I'm watching and I'm like, you know, say what you will about this film, the cow costume is amazing. And then after a while, I'm like, oh, okay, it's just a cow. Fair enough.
Yeah, no, it's
it was good. Yeah, that was like them doing a lot with a little. Is my thinking.
Yeah,
yeah. As they say, it was budgeted at $8 million, and it came in at $1 million under budget. And I'm like, yeah.
Uh huh.
That's no surprise.
And you can see it on the screen. And again, that's not on it. So I was just like, they're smart with the money.
Yep.
They knew what they didn't have to spend it.
Do you know the connection between this and Superman the movie?
I would love a connection between this and Superman the movie.
It's the scene when Nick Rivers and whatever the hell Lucy Guttridge played, Hillary Fleming, are in the prop room. Full of props.
Yes.
And then she goes out, like, she goes out the window and looks down, and there's the miniature with the mice.
Right.
That's from Superman the movie. Not the mice, but the miniature model.
Oh, is it?
Yep.
That's awesome.
Apparently they found it in Shepperton Studios and were like, huh, this is cool. Can we put it in the film somewhere? And they figured out a way.
Nice. Yeah, again, like, that kind of joke was fun. You know, it's interesting. Some of the dinner scenes, some of the just kind of like East German life, like, not, you know, just satire scenes, remind me a bit of Tati's Playtime.
Yeah.
If kind of done by fumbling Americans.
Yes. Oh. Yeah, no, there are some, I mean,
I have thought about, by the way, suggesting. We do Playtime. There's no way to discuss that film here.
It would be a difficult one, but I mean, I'll watch. I have it on Blu-ray. I'm gonna watch it.
I have the entire Criterion collection of Tati, so I'm right there with you.
All right.
Awesome. A friend of mine introduced me to Playtime, and I was just like, "Fuck yes, holy shit!" just to break into top secret for a minute. Seriously, if you've never seen Tati's Playtime, like, it is a revelation of just what you can do with shapes and color and timing. I mean, you know, he's a mime, and there is dialogue, but the dialogue almost never matters.
No.
And not just, in the least. Jesus, the humor and the escalation thereof is...
I mean...
It's a masterpiece.
Plus, just the story of how, look, he basically built a small city, like, to make this film. I mean, that's... The whole thing just blows my mind when I watch it. Think about it.
Yeah,
I'm gonna go out on a limb here. This might make some people angry, but I think Jacques Tati's Playtime is a better film than Top Secret.
I don't think that's gonna make anyone angry because it's just true.
It's funny when you said this is gonna make people angry. I thought, oh boy, now he's just gonna insult a bunch of people by name. And another one. This guy.
See, that would, if I was in this film, that's what would happen.
That's right. So I also, another thing that fascinates me about Top Secret is its proper title is not Top Secret, but Top Secret with an exclamation mark.
Sure.
And so I was like, what other shows do can I think of with that have an exclamation mark? So I scrolled a few down. Airplane is one.
Yeah.
Mamma Mia. Darren Aronofsky's Mother.
I was going to say, Mars Attacks has one, doesn't it?
Mars Attacks, yes. Teen Titans Go.
Sure.
Apparently Three Amigos, actually, the proper title is.
A movie that we covered in this podcast, in fact, does as well.
Oh, yeah. I can't remember which one was it.
That Thing You Do.
That's right. Oh, Hail Caesar.
That's, Tora Tora has three of them. So.
I know. Richard Linklater's Everybody Wants Some. 2 exclamation marks at the end. I just think that this is such a putting punctuation in movie titles just seems to me such a strange strategy. I don't know why. I always feel that when you see like, I think it's not, exclamation marks are okay, but a question mark at the end is box office death in my mind.
Is it? No, I just want to look up. Hold on. Movies with a question mark in the title. I'm just curious.
Yeah,
yeah. To see. I don't see many.
No, there aren't. No, there are very few.
But here's the thing. There were two I could think of, and I don't think it's A Kiss of Death. Because whatever happened to Baby Jane and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Do those actually have question marks?
Baby Jane does, I believe.
Okay.
Let me... I love that we've turned to this.
But I mean, how much are we reasonably going to say about Top Secret? Come on. Do you want me to like go through the cast and see which ones might have been in The Equalizer?
Whatever happened to Baby Jane definitely does.
Uh-huh.
And Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. So yeah.
Yep. Okay. But those are really the only two that I can be thinking of.
So you're saying that 2024 is Who's Afraid of a Cheap Old House? Movie that none of us, I don't think anyone has ever, it's a TV show, so it doesn't even matter.
Yeah,
I'm just like, the hell are you talking about?
But they're not going to put that on the big screen because it's got a question mark at the end.
Okay, so here's a fun fact, though.
Okay.
If you go to IMDb and you put a question mark in the search field just by itself, the first thing you pull up is Mark Hamill.
What?
I would like an explanation, please.
I'm sure Mark Hamill would as well. Oh yeah. There must be
something. There's something.
That is very strange.
So but anyway, Top Secret, again, the best thing in it, outside of the two scenes we've talked about, is hands down. Obviously, Val Kilmer. Like, you can't...
Yeah.
Like, I remember I saw this for the first time when I was a kid. I didn't know who Val Kilmer was. Because, again, I saw it, like, in the 80s. He hadn't really done anything else. And he was the memorable thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
Like, I mean, obviously, it's very sad that he passed, but so many people were saying, and they're absolutely right, that it was almost a curse that he, you know, he was a character actor with a leading man face.
Oh, okay.
And it kind of trapped him because he didn't get the weird roles. And that is the thing, is that we're going to, just so people know, we are going to go through a bunch of Val Kilmer movies, some of them, you know, at least one more directly, and then we'll see it a few in. But all of his best roles are the ones where he is allowed to be weird. Those are the memorable ones.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. He's very rarely boring. He's,
right. And, I mean, something that is not on our list because it shouldn't be. It's not a great movie. The Saint? Which I only watched because I'm a Val Kilmer fan. Not a good movie at all.
I watched because I watched movies and that one passed in front of my eyes one time.
That's fair. No, it's not good at all, but Kilmer is remarkable at it. That Heart of Darkness, you know the one I mean, about the lions.
Oh, yeah, The Ghosts in the Darkness.
Ghosts in the Darkness. Again, not a great movie, but Kilmer is remarkable in it. Man. Like, that was, you are never bored when Kilmer is on a screen.
True.
even like Top Gun, which I do just like Top Gun, for its, you know, all of its weirdness.
It was good to see him in Top Gun Maverick as well.
Oh well, yeah, that was kind of
a heartbreaking scene because we knew that Kilmer was, you know, sick, etc.
Can I read you? There's a Tumblr post that is considered the all time like just Top Gun.
Okay.
Breakdown.
Sure.
Top Gun is great because Tony Scott was like, I want to make a movie about sunsets. And the U.S. Navy was like, no, you're going to make a recruitment propaganda film for the Navy. And Val Kilmer was like, the studios tricked me, Juilliard trained Val Kilmer, into being here, so I'm going to portray a closeted homosexual. And Tom Cruise was like, I'm in a Ray-Bans commercial. And then fucking come up Top Gun, I don't know what does.
Oh my God, that's, yeah, that is perhaps the best movie review I have ever heard.
That really is just, that's Top Gun. That, it is all of those things at once, and somehow it fucking works, and it shouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
It does leave off the Anthony Edwards doesn't know what film he's in, but... Oh, but you know, like, Val Kilmer is just so obviously just, like, fuck you, I don't care what this movie is, I'm just doing my own thing.
Yep.
But in a way that never hurt the movie, only elevated it, which is the skill.
Oh, yeah. Agreed.
You know, we've talked about one day doing some Batman stuff. Like, his Batman, the Schumacher Batmans, I know a lot of people don't like them, but he was just so much weird fun in those. In that one, I guess.
He was only in one, right? Yeah.
Yeah, he was replaced by Clooney.
Man, that was a weird choice. But apparently, Kilmer was not always easy to work with, as they say.
Yes.
Which I think is what makes his appearance in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang interesting, alongside Robert Downey Jr.
Also true.
That Shane Black felt like he was not rehabilitating, but sort of like using two actors known for having some careers that stalled out, partly because of their own difficulty. And sort of reminding you just of how good they both were.
Yeah, I'm sure that eventually we will do that movie. So I don't want to get too deep into it now. And as much as I love Nice Guys, which, you know, kind of its spiritual successor.
Yeah.
I will always be a little sad that we don't just have a run of Kiss Kiss Bang Bang sequels. Just the world deserved. Yeah. Like, that deserved to just be a show and just pay them whatever the fuck they want. Just...
Yeah, you will never be able to explain to me why it is that there aren't sequels to either Kiss Kiss Bang Bang or The Nice Guys. Because they're just both, like, such fine-tuned engines. Yeah. And that could just... But it's also, like, just endlessly regenerative. You can take these characters and, you know, run them through their paces again and again. It would never get boring.
So anyway... Top Secret. I feel like we've, you know, this might be a very short episode. And again, if we were going to talk about Kilmer, we wanted to start here. But that doesn't mean there's honestly a lot to say about it.
Oh, no. I was watching it and I'm like, well, this is not going to be one of our more in-depth ones. I mean, the only thing you can really do with this movie is just go over the jokes, which, you know, if you want that, just watch the movie.
Right. And like the past that, you can talk about like one or two scenes and the fact that Val Kilmer killed.
Yeah.
And that's about it.
It also made me think about jokes that are sort of just references to like current things. I'm just thinking about how many movies are just that, you know, that come out now are often just like riffs on pop culture and stuff, and how forgettable they're going to be because. Like, there's several jokes in here.
Like the Pinto?
Yes. Yeah, the Ford Pinto joke.
Well, I think that's good, though, because...
Yeah.
And let's get into a broader conversation, but, like, you know, pop culture, like, and this is the internet kind of ruining pop culture, right? Because pop culture is supposed to be, by definition, disposable.
Yes.
And so you kind of want the, it's of the moment, and past the moment, it doesn't matter.
Right. But the internet freezes it and
codifies it, and then everything has to not be pop culture anymore. We're not allowed to make fun of that stuff because, well, it might not be relevant in 10 years.
Right.
And again, that does a huge disservice to everything.
Also, the speaking of the Tumblrification of things, making fun of anything in pop culture, you run the risk of somebody going, well, that forgettable piece of slop was like, that saved my life. And I'm like,
oh, well, sure. But I mean, anytime you crack a joke with anything, again, and we're talking specifically so you're not punching down because there are limits.
Exactly.
It is not going to, you know, anything's going to offend anybody. You know what I mean by that? Like,
yeah,
you can't make a joke about wrenches without somebody who loves wrenches getting mad. And that's okay. You know, again, as long as you're not punching down.
That's
and
true.
Just making fun of, you know, things that people can't control, like wrenches, you're fine.
As a professional plumber.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't believe your take on wrench. I can't believe you thought an X wrench was a Y wrench.
But yeah, I think that's really about where we live with this. But next time, we're going to actually, you know, this is going to be a back-to-back Val Kilmering. We are going to talk about one of the most important movies, and I will explain why next week, but seriously, one of the single most important movies in my life. Believe it or not.
Okay.
Yeah. We will be talking about Real Genius, and honestly, like, just in my own existence is that incredibly important.
I want to hear this.
Yeah, it's the whole thing.
I gotta wait.
Yeah, everyone has to wait. Oh, but now we'll give some music. Woo, music.
There's schnitzel in my later hosen. Whatever.